Well, I want to thank everybody for coming out, listening, giving us a venue. I want to thank the Labor College. It's a really wonderful place. My name is Zoli Peter Goodman, formerly known as Petty Officer Goodman, United States Navy, V-1 Division, Air Department, USS John F. Kennedy, CV-67. Hua. Regardless of your political viewpoints, regardless of your personal feelings, one day the United States military will leave Iraq. When we do, all we will have to show for it is thousands of dead Americans. In the meantime, the war ends every single day for our soldiers because someone is discharged from the United States military every single day. They're discharged with no assistance into the VA system. Some people are discharged without knowing that they qualify for veterans benefits like I was. And with that statement said, I'm going to move into my testimony. I'm going to briefly cover something that happened while I was on active duty, which as many people know and many people are told to join the military, that you will receive health care, your family will receive health care, your dependents will receive health care, and no one can take that health care away from you. September 2005, I was on a training operation deployed out of Jacksonville, Florida. We were underway. My wife was pregnant with my unborn child. While I was on that training operation, my wife began the horrible process of a miscarriage. Being home by herself, the first thing she did was call the TRICARE hotline. TRICARE is the healthcare service that's provided to us in the military. The lady on the hotline told her that she probably already had lost her child and that there was nothing they could do. She asked for an ambulance, and she was told that if she had $1,500, they were willing to send an ambulance. Not having $1,500 on the salary of an E-4, she chose not to get the ambulance, and she called a friend of mine and waited for him to come pick her up at our apartment and drove her to base. There's a hospital on Naval Station Mayport. It's called the hospital at Naval Station Mayport. And she arrived there at 4 p.m. She went inside, and the nurse told her that they were closing at 4:30 and they couldn't help her. She insisted to see a doctor. The doctor told her that they could not help her, and she was turned away. And she once again waited in the parking lot while she was bleeding for my friend to take her to another hospital 23 miles away called the hospital NAS Jacksonville. No ambulance was provided, nothing, no assistance, and we lost the child. She sent a Red Cross message to me on the ship. Upon receiving the Red Cross message, I requested to take leave. I went home on leave with no assistance, no plane ticket. The money that I did spend on a plane ticket to get home left me in a very hard position with a wife who needed health care that I could not provide for her, and neither could my government, apparently. Later on after that incident, I was discharged with no access to the VA, no assistance with help into the VA. Finally, finding out that I qualified for veterans health care, I found the application online, filled it out, and sent it in to be processed. The processing of this application took several months. I don't know how many because I lost track of time, but it was at least three. Upon requesting mental health and mental help over the phone, I was told that I could not get an appointment for 3 months, and I did not make an appointment. A few days later, I looked up the law, and the law says that the VA only has a 30-day maximum to provide an appointment for someone requesting an appointment. So I called this wonderful organization back, and I cited the laws of our wonderful country, and I was given an appointment, and like every other appointment that I've ever had from the Veterans Administration, it was 30 days later. So I went and I showed up at this appointment, and I was inducted into what is a processing system set up to deter people from seeking help. I was spoken to with no compassion. Every single phone call I make to the VA, I'm asked if I'm going to kill myself or somebody else in the most inhumane way you could imagine by the most inhumane people you could imagine. So after going through this process, the first thing they tried to do was medicate me. No therapy was recommended. Medications were recommended. They gave me 3 different medications. The first was trazodone, the second was Paxil, and the third was gabapentin, a generic form of Neurontin. My doctor did not give me any information on these medications. He told me that PTSD treatment is not a science, that there is no science to it, and that you can mix and match these medications and something may work for you that doesn't work for another vet. So I left my appointment that day and I went home and I did research on the medications that I was given. And I found out that the main side effect of all 3 medications is suicidal thoughts and suicidal tendencies. And that's disgusting. And that man should be disgusted with himself, and every doctor that does that should be disgusted with himself. So upon deciding not to take the medication, I decided I would try therapy. So once again, I called the VA and requested therapy. I was told that I couldn't get an appointment for several months, and I cited the law again, and I was given an appointment 30 days later. So now I get to go to a 15-minute therapy session once every 30 days. And when I show up to my 15-minute therapy session, there's 15 other Vietnam vets that have the same 8 a.m. appointment that I do, and we all wait around in the lobby. Every single one of these vets is there seeking help and treatment for the same thing that I'm seeking help and treatment for, and they're all 30 years older than I am. They've been in the system 30 years longer. They've been taking the same medications for 30 years, the same therapists for 30 years, and they're still there, and they still have the same problem. So obviously, it doesn't work. There's no solution with the current situation.
Sorry, hold on.
So Lee Peter Goodman, who is testifying about his experience in difficulty getting medical care in the VA system.
So when I'm not at the VA, and I'm around town, everywhere I go, I see homeless vets. Because 1/3 of the homeless population is veterans. And that's disgusting. You won't find a more rigorous interview process in the entire world than what it takes to join the United States military. To misdiagnose someone and tell them that they have a pre-existing medical condition that wasn't caught in the most rigorous screening process in the entire world for the greatest military in the entire world is hearsay. It's a lie. Everybody knows it's a lie. I know when I was in boot camp, I didn't see anybody that had any kind of mental trauma. In fact, when I was going through the process, they weeded people out. And they said, you can't join. It says here you told a recruiter that you thought about killing yourself one time. We don't allow that in the military, and we're sorry. I've seen that with my own eyes. So these men are lied to. These men are misdiagnosed. And once they're misdiagnosed, they can't reach the VA. They can't get help for something that was a pre-existing condition because it wasn't caused by the military. It is so detrimental, it is so frustrating, it is so angering to me, and I'm sure every single vet in this room that has ever walked into a VA hospital on their own accord to seek treatment or to somehow comfort the people that are trapped inside of these establishments. 10,000 Iraq war vets have committed suicide. My name is Zoli Peter Goodman. I'm a proud warrior and a prouder patriot. And that's my problem with the VA.
Zoli Peter Goodman, veteran from the Navy, with an emotional testimony about his difficulty getting treatment from the VA system after having served in the Navy.
A recent report documented 935 lies told by top officials in the administration in the 2 years between September 11, 2001 and the invasion of Iraq. What then is the real reason that so many have been made to suffer so much? Here's Michael Schwartz, professor of sociology at SUNY Stony Brook, and the author of many books and articles, including his recent War Without End, The Iraq War in Context. He spoke last month at a Connecticut United for Peace conference.
So what has been the motivation of the American leadership, not just the Bush administration, but the loyal opposition in Congress and all the rest of our visible leaders, to continuing and persevering in this war, you know, to the point where, of course, McCain says 100 years is all right. It's so important that we should remain 100 years. What are they actually fighting for? You know, the history of the rationalization for this, of course, is walked through many things that many of us could easily see were not true at the time, but in retrospect have become completely irrelevant. The WMDs, for example, but even the idea of bringing democracy to Iraq has, you know, just sort of drifted away into the ether now as not really part of anything they're speaking about anymore. And yet they persevere. There's always a new reason developed. And, you know, the answer is it's the oil, stupid.
Right.
And I'm sure most of you here have heard the name, the Project for a New American Century, and I want to just briefly mention that, which is a fascinating group because it was made up of people who had served in the Reagan and Bush administrations, the first Bush administration, and then they were basically out of Washington, but still, you know, very concerned about American policy all during the Clinton time. And they formed this group, the PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, in order to articulate their viewpoint about what American foreign policy should look like, right? And one of the things that they really latched onto was the fall of the Soviet Union had created a unipolar moment. Well, the original idea was that it was a unipolar moment, right? That is, here's a moment when there's only one superpower, right? You know, we stand alone, right? Their idea was is that that shouldn't be a moment. That should be the American century, the new American century, right? Let's not have just a moment. Let's have a whole 100 years of this. This sounds good to us, right? And they began to develop a theory of power, right, that a lot of you might say is kind of intuitive if you look at American history, but to them they saw it as really fresh and important, which is that the United States would be the overwhelmingly preeminent military power in the world. So finally what you get is you get the 1990s coming along with the Project for a New American Century developing its ideas. And you have to really understand what happened in the 1990s as far as oil goes. Okay? A tremendous thing is going on in the 1990s. The first thing is that the amount of oil that's being discovered is starting to really decrease. You've probably heard the phrase peak oil, and we don't have to argue about whether it's coming, whether it's near, or whether it's already passed. Because what is indubitable and nobody disagrees with is that the expanded need for oil is now going faster than the expansion of the supply of oil. And it's only an argument about where those 2 points are crossed and we won't have enough. Well, basically what happened, the 1990 Gulf War, really was the warning moment. Because during that period, the oil from Iraq and Kuwait were, for a short period of time, off the market. 4 million barrels a day. And for the first time up to that moment, the Saudis, with some help from other countries that were friendly to the United States, could not cover the difference. And they experienced a huge oil shock. And as a matter of fact, it was probably the key thing, among many things, that triggered the recession in the United States that brought President Bush down, right? So this was not something where, well, we had an oil shortage and we figured out how to handle it. Something where we had an oil shortage and they didn't figure out how to handle it. And they saw the writing on the wall there. And this is one of the things that animated the people in the Project for a New American Century. And it goes on right through the 90s. And if you're wondering why, for example, that Jimmy Carter was such... Jimmy Carter, there's a nice slip. Bill Clinton, right, was so belligerent towards Iraq, right? You know, our nice liberal president, right, was quite belligerent towards Iraq. Undertook major military attacks against Iraq that, you know, were mercifully not publicized by the major media, right, he was very taken up with the fact that, we're really in trouble about oil in the Middle East. Oil in the Middle East became an ongoing crisis. And Iraq became the kind of centerpiece of that crisis for several sets of reasons. One of them is that Iraq, together with Iran, and then later in 1999, together with Venezuela, began to look like a polarity of groups that were unwilling to kind of program to whatever energy policy about the Middle East that the United States wanted to implement. Whereas we had our friendly ally, the Saudis, which turned out to be not too friendly and not that much of an ally towards the end of the decade, right? These guys were inalterably opposed to us, right? So, and they began to form a polarity. Second thing about Iraq, really important, is that Iraqi production, which had been at about 3 million barrels a day, made it second at the time, then finally third, right, back in the early period, in the late 70s, early 80s, had never recovered from, A, the Iraq-Iran war and the American attack, right, but was starting to recover in the late 90s. And not only that, the sanction regime, which was placed to control Saddam Hussein, right, was getting lessened and lessened because the world was so starving for oil, and he was able to get more and more autonomy over his oil. And in the late 90s, so he was starting to really be a factor in pricing and production. And finally, and most of all, in 1997 for the first time, briefly, and then in 1998 permanently, the United States became an oil-importing country for real. The percentage of oil that we imported passed the 50% mark. And it's sort of like, you know, the four-minute mile. That's it, folks. You know, we now know we're in trouble. Right? And so all these things are maturing in the 90s. And there has to be an energy policy. Right? And so when the Bush administration takes office, they immediately go for a comprehensive energy policy. And we all know the name of this, the Cheney Energy Task Force, right? It met 2 weeks after President Bush took power. They were planning it beforehand. We've got to go right straight ahead to an energy policy. Now, what were they talking about and what did they decide? Well, first of all, what they decided, and this is really the most monumental of the things they decided was, is that conservation and alternative fuels were not going to be the strategy. Right, that was sort of fundamental. That was decided the first couple of days. And that what they were going to talk about is how to increase oil production sufficiently to buy what they settled on was about 15 years. Buy 15 years of oil while we figure out the rest of it. Okay. And then the second thing they came up with is we can do this. And the way we can do this is by doubling production in the Middle East. The only place where oil is ample enough to supply enough to get back to the point where supply is above demand, right? Double production in the Middle East. There's only one big problem with that. There wasn't a single Middle East producer who wants to do that, right? Not just those damn, you know, Axis of Evil guys, Iran and Iraq, not that horrible Chavez in Venezuela, right? They don't want to do it, but neither does Kuwait, neither does Saudi Arabia. Why should these guys want to do it? They got nowhere to put the money. They've stolen everything they can steal from their people, right? All they're doing is investing in the United States economy, which is a really bad investment, right, in fact. And that's a large part of the story here. It's a really big part of the story is that the U.S. is a really lousy investment, right? So why should they want to increase production at all? Well, as a matter of fact, what the United States wants is them for double production. They can keep the price of oil. The ambition was bring the price of oil down from $30 a barrel, folks, you know, right? That's what it was when the war started, right? $30 a barrel. Let's bring it down to 20 or even 15 by doubling production, right? So if you think about it for a second, if you bring it from 30 to 15, the Middle East gets to double production without increasing revenues at all, right? What are they? Communists, right. Something, right. I mean, why would anybody go for this, right? I mean, even, you know, the most vicious regime that doesn't give a damn about their own people, well, they do give a damn about their oil revenues that they're going to get to steal and invest, right? So why would they want to do this, right? And of course they didn't. The Saudis didn't want to do it. The Kuwaitis didn't want to do it. The United Arab Emirates wouldn't want to do it. And the Cheney Commission said, you see, these guys are really deadbeats. You know, they're really terrible. Now, we got to find a way to coerce them to do it. And their basic plan was, the basic plan that they came up with was, is we've got to privatize the oil again. Because if we can get this oil, you know, everybody talks about the United States is trying to get its hands on the Iraqi oil. And then the conservatives say, you can always buy the oil. And it's true. That's a good answer to the idea that what the United States is trying to do is grab the oil. You can buy lots of oil on the open market. All you got to do is bid up the price, and you'll get it, right? That's not the point of all this. The point is it's to double production. That you can't do by bidding up the price. Because these guys are not going to increase production. In fact, the idea is to get it privatized, right? So reverse the nationalization of oil. This is all in the Cheney Commission report, the public parts of it. Right? Of course, how are you going to do this? How are you going to possibly do this? Well, that's where Iraq is really a great idea, okay? Because Iraq has three things about it that make it a very attractive place to look for your answer, okay? Number one is that for 20 years under the horror of the Saddam Hussein regime, Iraq has been working with only a fraction of their proven reserves. So if we could only get in there, we could develop their proven reserves, which are three times as large as what they're exploiting, and we could get production up from, it was down to about 2.5 at the time of the invasion. We could get this up to 5 at least, no time flat. But better than that, there's been no exploration for the last 25 years. So Iraq, of all the places, has the most amount of unfound reserves. And the most optimistic estimates said that Iraq had more oil than Saudi Arabia, which means that if we could open all that up, we could get them up to 10 million barrels a day, exceed Saudi Arabia. And by itself, Iraq could take care of half of the surplus that we need to generate. And then we'll use the presence of Iraq and our presence in Iraq to leverage everybody else. And if worse comes first, what we'll do is we will knock over Iran, and we'll do the same thing there, and we'll be done, right? And these other guys will have to fold in anyway, right? So this is, right, if we can conquer Iraq, we can do anything, right? We go in there, we'll privatize the oil, we'll exploit the oil, we'll multiply production tremendously, we'll change everything that's going on, we'll have all our troops sitting there, we'll tell Iran, unless you open up your oil, you know, you're out of trouble. And we'll also say to Saudi Arabia, at least these neocons, you know, if you go back and read what they were saying right at about that time, they were saying, Saudi Arabia is not our friend. They are an enemy of ours. You know, we have to really leverage them, blah, 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 blah. Even Kuwait, you know, hey, guys, you do it or you're in trouble, right? So the whole thing, the linchpin becomes using the military in order to create a solution for our energy problem.
Professor Michael Schwartz, author of War Without End, The Iraq War in Context. We'll conclude the program with more witness testimony. You'll notice that some of the testimony has been censored by the Pacifica radio anchors in order to comply with FCC rules. You see, people are not allowed to say or hear on radio those F and S words that everyone uses daily and that half my third grade class knew. But it is perfectly okay to broadcast wall-to-wall lies in the media. No problem with children hearing that.
Hello, my name is Jason Washburn. I was a corporal in the United States Marine Corps, in which I served 4 years. I did 3 tours in Iraq. My first 2 tours were with the 1st Battalion, 4th Marines, Charlie Company. And my third tour was with 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, Weapon Company. I was in the initial invasion, and eventually after the invasion was done, we settled down in Al-Hilla. This was in 03. From 04 to 05, I was in Najaf, and from 05 to 06, I was in Haditha. During the course of my 3 tours, the rules of engagement changed a lot. It seemed like every time we turned around, we had different rules of engagement, and they told us the reasons they were changing them was because it depended on the climate of the area at the time, what the threat level was deemed to be. And the higher the threat level was, the more viciously we were permitted and expected to respond. And for example, during the invasion, we were told to use target identification before engaging with anyone. But if the town or the city that we were approaching was a known threat, if the unit that went through the area before we did took a high number of casualties, we were basically we were allowed to shoot whatever we wanted. It was deemed to be a free fire zone. So we would roll through the town, and anything that we saw, everything that we saw, we engaged it and opened fire on everything. And let's see. And there was really, there was really no rule governing the amount of force we were allowed to use on targets during the invasion. I remember one woman was walking by, and she was carrying a huge bag, and she looked like she was heading towards us. So we lit her up with the Mark 19, which is an automatic grenade launcher. And when the dust settled, we realized that the bag was only full of groceries. And, she had been trying to bring us food, and we blew her to pieces for it. After the invasion ended and Bush declared mission accomplished, the rules changed pretty drastically. Instead of actually firing, we used a lot of, close combat, just hand-to-hand type stuff, just simple hand-to-hand violence to subdue people. There were a lot of times where we would be out on foot patrols, and we were ordered to not allow people to pass through our patrol formation, and unsuspecting villagers would try to pass through or cut through the formation, and we would butt-stroke them, jab them with the muzzle, kick them or whatever, just get them out of the formation. And one time there was a guy on a bicycle with a basket full of groceries, and he tried to just roll through. And, we clotheslined him and smashed up his bicycle for what? Passing through the formation. And but this is like what we were expected to do. And in another instance, we were ordered to guard a fuel station. At the end of the day, like nothing had happened, and we had mounted up into our trucks, and right when we were about to take off, a bunch of people, Iraqi people, rushed the fuel pumps to try to take some fuel, and our squad leader called it in, and the response was over the radio was, what do you think we want you to do? Go F them up. Obviously, in more colorful, language, but so we jumped off the trucks and charged at the Iraqis, and we really beat the hell out of them. And with rifles, fists, feet, everything else that we had available, so once they had either fled or were broken and bleeding, unconscious on the ground, we mounted back up in our trucks and left. We were never told to detain anyone there or, question anyone. It just messed them up, And most of the innocents that I actually saw get killed were behind the wheel of a vehicle, usually a taxi driver. I've been present for almost a dozen of those types of people that got killed just driving. During my third deployment, there was a rule in place where all Iraqi traffic had to pull off of the road to let military convoys pass by. If they didn't comply or somebody got back on the road too early, they would get shot up. If they approached a checkpoint too fast or too recklessly, they would get shot up. Also, we were often told to be on the lookout for vehicle-borne IEDs, improvised explosive devices. Matching the description of every taxi in Iraq. Be on the lookout for a car that has orange panel doors and, front that's white or you know, vice versa. And it's like every taxi in Iraq, that's exactly what it looks like. And those are the cars that we're supposed to be looking out for that could be, you know, VBIEDs. And so quite a few of those guys got shot up just because their car looked like what we were told to look out for. In another instance, it was actually a mayor of a town in our AO near Haditha that got shot. Our command showed us pictures from the incident. They had gathered the whole company together, and they were showing pictures of all of this, what everything looked like, and pointed out the reason that they did this was because there was a really nice, tight shot group in the windshield, and he announced to the company that this is what good Marine shooting looks like. And that was the mayor of the town. And it was actually my squad that was after that tasked with going to apologize to the family and pay reparations. But it was kind of like, basically all we did was go there and, you know, give them some money and then leave. And, you know, oh well, is, you know, the way, you know, it seemed they wanted us to apologize to them. It was really a joke. Something else we were actually encouraged to do, almost with a wink and a nudge, was to carry drop weapons, or by my third tour, drop shovels. What that basically is we would carry these weapons or shovels with us because in case we accidentally did shoot a civilian, we could just toss the weapon on the body and make them look like they were an insurgent. Or, you know, like my friend here was saying, we were told by my third tour that if they were carrying a shovel or, you know, in a heavy bag, if they were digging anywhere, especially near roads, that we could shoot them. And so we actually carried these, you know, tools and weapons in our vehicles in case we accidentally shot an innocent civilian, and we could just toss it on there and be like, well, he was digging. I was within the rules of engagement. And this was commonly encouraged, but only behind closed doors. It wasn't obviously a public announcement that they would make. Yeah, it was pretty common. And so, yep, that's all I have to say.
That was Jason Washburn. Corporal Washburn did 3 tours in Iraq, testifying again about rules of engagement here at Winter Soldier 2008.
Now it's time to hear from our next panelist.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Wayne Lemieux, and I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. I served 4 years and 10 months in the United States Marine Corps Infantry and was honorably discharged with the rank of sergeant. During my time in the Marine Corps, I served 3 deployments to Iraq, including the invasion. And in case any inquiring minds want to know, I served 4 years and 10 months because I voluntarily extended my enlistment contract by 10 months to redeploy with my unit for the third tour. My first tour started in January 2003 and ended in September of that year. My second tour was from February to September of 2004, and my last tour was from September 2005 to March 30th, 2006. Proper rules of engagement serve an important strategic purpose, which is to legitimize military force. By projecting an image of restraint and professionalism, militaries seek to reinforce the idea that they're protecting local residents rather than oppressing them. Not only do these rules undermine support for any local opposition, they also deflect accusations of occupation and oppression from foreign countries and in some cases, the people of the country the military is supposedly serving. Martin Van Creveld, who was an Israeli military historian, even asserted some years ago that the British had not yet been driven from Northern Ireland because they were taking more casualties than the Irish were. The U.S., on the other hand, has not chosen to use rules of engagement in the same way in Iraq. The rules of engagement have been broadly defined and loosely enforced to protect U.S. service members at the expense of the Iraqi people. And anyone who tells you different is either a liar or a fool. During the invasion of Iraq, during the push north to Baghdad, the rules of engagement given to me were gradually reduced to the point of non-existence, similar to the cases that you've already heard. When we first crossed the Kuwait-Iraq border at Azubair in March 2003, we were operating under Geneva Convention guidelines and were authorized to shoot anyone wearing a military uniform, except for medical and religious personnel, unless they had surrendered. By the time we got to Baghdad, however, I was explicitly told by my chain of command that I could shoot anyone who came closer to me than I felt comfortable with if that person did not immediately move when I ordered them to do so, keeping in mind I don't speak Arabic. The general attitude that I got from my chain of command was better them than us, and the guidance that we were given reinforced that attitude across the ranks. It was an attitude that I watched intensify greatly throughout the course of my three tours. I remember in January of 2004 attending the formation where we were given what was going to be our mission for the second deployment. And I was sitting there like a good Marine with my pen and paper, ready to write down those carefully chosen, thoughtful words that would justify my existence in Iraq for the next 7 months. And my commander told me that our mission was, and I quote, to kill those who need to be killed and save those who need to be saved. And that was it. And with those words, he pretty much set the tone for the deployment. At the start of that second deployment, our standing rules of engagement were that someone had to be displaying hostile intent and committing a hostile act before deadly force could be used. I won't get into the absurdity of asking one to discern what is going on in the mind of another individual, except to say that it was the individual Marine's job to determine what is hostile intent and a hostile action. However, during the April offensive of 2004, in which attacks erupted all over Anbar province, my unit was involved in a two-day firefight. Shortly after the firefight was underway, the same commander who had given us the mission issued an order that everyone wearing a black dashdasha and a red headscarf was automatically displaying hostile intent and a hostile action and was to be shot. An hour or two later, he gave another order, this time that everyone on the streets was considered an enemy combatant. I can remember one instance after the order was given that afternoon when we came around a corner and an unarmed Iraqi man stepped out of a doorway. I remember the Marine directly in front of me raising his rifle and aiming at the unarmed man, and then I think just for some psychological reason my brain blocked out the actual shots, because the next thing I remember is stepping over the dead man's body to clear the room that he came out of. I remember that it was a storage room, and it was full of some Arabic brand of Iraq, or some Arabic brand of cheesy poofs, like Cheetos. There weren't any weapons in the area except for ours. The commander told us a couple of weeks later that over 100 enemy, quote-unquote, had been killed, and to the best of my knowledge, that number includes all of the people who were shot for simply walking down the street in their own city. After the firefight was over, the standing rules of engagement for my unit were changed so that Marines didn't need to identify a hostile action anymore in order to use deadly force. They just had to identify hostile intent. The rules also explicitly stated that carrying a shovel, standing on a rooftop while speaking on a cell phone or holding binoculars, or being out after curfew were automatically considered hostile intent, and we were authorized to use deadly force. And I can only guess how many innocent people died during my tour because of those orders. On my third tour, the rules of engagement were stricter, but they really only existed so that the command could say there were rules of engagement that were being followed. In reality, my officers explicitly told me and my fellow Marines that if we felt threatened by an Iraqi's presence, we should just shoot them and the officers would, quote-unquote, take care of us. By this time, many of the Marines who were on their second or third tour had suffered such serious psychological trauma, having watched friends die and lose limbs, that because of these experiences, they were moved to shoot people who, in my opinion, were clearly non-combatants. There was one incident when a roadside bomb exploded, and a few minutes later, I watched a Marine start shooting at cars that were driving down the street hundreds of meters away and in the opposite direction from where the IED had exploded. We were too far away to identify who was in the cars, and they didn't pose any threat to us, and for all I could tell, as I was standing about 20 meters away from the Marine and about 300 meters from the cars, they were just passing motorists. It was long enough after and far enough away from the explosion that the people in the cars might not have even known that anything was going on or that anything had even happened, but the Marine was shooting at them anyway. This Marine had had his best friend get killed on our last deployment and had also related to me a story about the two-day firefight that I mentioned earlier when he watched the commander who had given us the order to shoot anyone on the street shoot two old ladies that were walking and carrying vegetables. He said that the commander had told him to shoot the woman, and when he refused because they were carrying vegetables, the commander shot them. So when this Marine started shooting at people in cars that nobody else felt were threatening, he was only following the example that his commander had already set. I don't have anywhere near enough time to tell you every related experience that I had in Iraq. But in general, the rules of engagement changed frequently, contradicted themselves, and when they were restrictive, they were either loosely enforced or escalations of force, as shootings of civilians were known, were not reported because Marines did not want to send their brothers in arms to prison when all they were trying to do was protect themselves in a situation they'd been forced into, where there was a constant, ambiguous, and deadly threat, and any citizen of the country that they were supposedly liberating could have been wearing an explosive vest. With no way to identify their attackers and no clear mission worth dying for, Marines viewed the rules of engagement as either a joke or a technicality to be worked around so that they could bring each other home alive. Not only are the misuse of rules of engagement in Iraq indicative of supreme strategic incompetence, they are also a moral disgrace. The people who have set them should be ashamed of ourselves, and they're just one of the many reasons why the troops should be withdrawn immediately from Iraq. Thank you.
Jason Lemieux getting a standing ovation here at Winter Soldier. He's a former Marine Corps sergeant, did three tours as an infantryman in Iraq.
Good afternoon. My name is John Michael Turner. I currently reside in Burlington, Vermont. I served with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines as an automatic machine gunner. There's a term, once a Marine, always a Marine, but there's also the term, eat the apple, F the Corps. I don't work for you no more.
John Michael just tossed his dog tags out to the crowd. The crowd is standing and cheering at his actions. Most of the crowd are Iraq, Afghanistan, Persian Gulf War, and Vietnam era veterans.
I served three deployments with Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines, one of which was in Haiti. The other two were in Iraq, in between Fallujah and Abu Ghraib the first time, and in downtown Ramadi at the government center the second time. I do have some video footage and pictures that I'll be sharing with you. The videos that I do have, there are swear words in there, so those that are live feeding this, you might need to turn the volume down. Could we please play the first video?
Okay, we're going to just cut away. Aaron Glantz and I are going to be talking over the videos at this point.
And what we're seeing now is an image of...
So this is going to be a video of my XO, or executive officer, at the time of Kilo Company. And in this video, he states, I think I just killed half the population of Northern Ramadi, F the red tape. Can you replay it, please?
We're not able to play the complete video and turn up the sound because of FCC limitations on the use of profanity, but the video shows an image out in the desert.
We're in Ramadi here, and the commanding officer of John Michael Turner's unit is speaking to them, instructing them that he doesn't care if the entire town of Ramadi is killed.
He said, I think I just killed half of the town of Ramadi, I believe he said, Aaron.
Thank you.
We had gone into a two-hour-long firefight, and it was over for quite some time, but he still felt the need to go ahead and drop a 500-pound laser-guided missile on it, and this is the after-effects of it.
And so now we're looking at an image, obviously taken from a distance, and I think we're going to see an explosion. There's an explosion there, the laser-guided bomb.
Huge explosions. Taken from a rooftop.
And we're just witnessing the damage of those explosions.
John Michael said that this explosion...
March 2006, we had gotten our rules of engagement brief at Camp Ramadi. Just after we had gotten that brief, our first sergeant had pulled my platoon aside and stated, If you feel threatened in any way, shape, or form, take care of the threat and we'll deal with it later. With that being said, mistakes were made on several occasions. One incident was this guy we called Mr. Wilson. My post was Post Alpha at the government center in the southwest corner, and his house was directly across the street. We had a high suicide vehicle-borne IED threat that day, and this car came running around the corner. And I fired one 50 caliber machine gun round at his direction, and it ricocheted off the ground through the floorboard of the car, through his shin, and then through the roof. The car immediately came to a stop, and outside of the car came seven of his daughters, including Mr. Wilson himself. Can you please play the next picture? This is another video of laser-guided bomb. I'm sorry I didn't show that, but please play this.
And that's another laser-guided bomb explosion.
That was done on the Ministry of Health building. This building was still in use. There were still people that went there. And that was a missile that just went into it. But back to where I was going with mistakes being made. Please go to the next picture. That is the site, looking down the sight of a 50 caliber machine gun. For those of you who don't know, the round is about 6 inches long, and the projectile is about an inch and a half long. There are many different types of rounds. The one that was shot at Mr. Wilson was a slap round, which has a polyurethane base and a titanium tip. When the projectile exits from the barrel of the 50 caliber machine gun, it spreads open like that. So it'll go into your body, leaving a hole about 4 inches and exit, leaving you with nothing. This will bring me to my next point. When mistakes were made, we carried drop weapons. Please go to the next picture. These weapons right here were taken from the Iraqi police back during our first deployment. And this is just an example that we would take their weapons and carry them around with us in case we did mess up and shot the wrong person. What we also did was any time we went into a household, we would take the firing pins out of the weapon. Every household is allowed to have one AK-47 for their own protection. And by taking out the firing pins, the weapons would not fire. Therefore, they had no protection against themselves or us. Please go to the next picture. This is what happens when you get hit with a 50 caliber. Next picture.
Showed a photo of a car with the front window blown out and bloody remains in the front seat.
For those of you who don't know, that is brains. That was not my kill. That was one of my friends. But that did happen on my deployment to Iraq. And afterwards, it just goes to show you that after the mistakes that we did made, we had no respect for their bodies afterwards. Please go to the next picture. That is a man's face. On April 2nd, 2005, at Abu Ghraib, we had a very highly coordinated attack on us. And the next day, we went ahead and had to search the premises for any remains. And obviously that face, or that part of the face, was found and put on top of a Kevlar so a picture could be taken of it. Next picture, please. This picture is kind of hard to see, but we had a mortar attack at Camp India, which was right in between Camp Fallujah and Abu Ghraib. And this was a 12-year-old worker who was building our camp for us, and he took a piece of shrapnel to the head. Is there any way you can move that? Okay. Next image, please. On April 18th, 2006, I had my first confirmed kill. This man was innocent. I don't know his name. I called him the fat man. He was walking back to his house, and I shot him in front of his friend and his father. The first round didn't kill him. After I had hit him, up here in his neck area. And afterwards, he started screaming and looked right into my eyes. So I looked at my friend who I was on post with, and I said, well, I can't let that happen. So I took another shot and took him out. He was then carried away by the rest of his family. It took 7 people to carry his body away. We were all congratulated after we had our first kills, and that happened to have been mine. My company commander personally congratulated me, as he did everyone else in our company. This is the same individual who had stated that whoever gets their first kill by stabbing them to death will get a 4-day pass when we return from Iraq. There's one incident where we got into a firefight just south of the government center, about 2,000 meters. We had no idea where the fire was coming from, and the way our rules of engagement were, pinpoint where the fire is coming from and throw a rocket at it. So with that being said, we still didn't know where the fire was coming from, and an 84-millimeter rocket was shot into a house. I do not know if there was anyone in it. We do not know if that's where the fire was coming from, but that's what was done. Please go to the next image. This man right here was my 3rd confirmed kill. As you can see, he was riding his bicycle. This later on in the day, we went ahead, and we had CBS Laura Logan with us, but she was with the other squad. And so she wasn't with us. So myself and 2 other people went ahead and took out some individuals because we were excited about the firefight we had just gotten into, and we didn't have a cameraman or woman with us. With that being said, anytime we did have embedded reporters with us, our actions would change drastically. We never acted the same. We were always on key with everything, did everything by the books. Please go to the next image. No, there's one at the... Well, the guy... No. The man on the bicycle, he was left in the street for about 10 minutes until we realized that we needed to leave where we were. And his body was dragged about 10 feet to the right of him, where his body was thrown behind a rock wall, and his bicycle was thrown on top of him. Another thing that we used to do a lot was recon by fire, where we would go ahead and try to start a firefight if we felt threatened in any way, shape, or form. There's one particular incident where we were working with the Iraqi Army and the Iraqi Special Forces in downtown Ramadi, and with our squad and the Iraqi Army, there was also lieutenant colonels, majors, first sergeants, and sergeant majors. Sorry, sergeants major. With that being said, the Iraqi Army would go into the house, kick in the doors, and then go ahead and shoot. And there were loud bursts of machine gun fire. We thought we were taking fire, but then we later found out that it was them. House raids. Because we were a grunt battalion, we were responsible for going on several patrols. A lot of the raids and patrols we did were at the night, around 3 o'clock in the morning, around there. And what we would do is just kick in the doors and terrorize the families. That was an image taken around 3 o'clock in the morning through night vision goggles. And that is the segregation of the women and children and the men. If the men of the household were giving us problems, we'd go ahead and take care of them any way we felt necessary, whether it be choking them or slamming their head against the walls. If you go back to that one picture, that was one man that wasn't taken, that was taken care of in a very bad way. Because of all the wiring that he had, we considered it IED-making material. On my wrist, there's Arabic for FU. I got that put on my wrist just 2 weeks before we went to Iraq because that was my choking hand. And anytime I felt the need to take out aggression, I would go ahead and use it. Please go to the next picture. Next. There's an instance of detainees and how they were treated in a nice manner. Next. That is the Fatemat Mosque minaret. As you can see, it is written with bullet holes and holes in the top of it. Those were from mortars. And the next video that I'm going to show you is a tank round that went into that minaret, where we weren't sure if we were taking fire or not. I'll talk about this one. This is after one of the guys in weapons company had gotten shot. This is a way that we would take out our aggression.
And we're seeing the entire minaret of a mosque being shot over and over again.
To shoot into a mosque unless you were taking fire from it. There was no fire that was taken from that mosque. It was shot into because we were angry. Okay, please play the next video.
We're going to the next video now. And now some of the soldiers are talking about the attack on the minaret. And we're just trying to follow it here for you. As we said, there's obscenities in some of these videos, so we want to make sure that we operate by the rules of broadcasting.
That... With that being said, there's many more stories and incidents for me to talk about, although we don't have the time to. But this just goes to show you that that was the after effect of the tank round. This just goes to show you that everyone sitting up here has these stories, and there's been over a million troops that have gone in and out of Iraq, so the possibilities are endless. Next image, please. The reason I am doing this today is not only for myself and for the rest of society to hear, but it's for all those who can't be here to talk about the things that we went through, talk about the things that we did. Next image. Those four crosses and this memorial service were for the five guys in Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 8th Marines that we lost. Throughout our unit, we had 18 that got killed. With that being said, that is my testimony. I just want to say that I am sorry for the hate and destruction that I have inflicted on innocent people, and I'm sorry for the hate and destruction that others have inflicted on innocent people. At one point, it was okay. But reality has shown that is not, and that this is happening, and that until people hear about what is going on with this war, it will continue to happen, and people will continue to die. I am sorry for the things that I did. I am no longer the monster that I once was. Thank you.
That was the moving, powerful testimony by John Michael Turner, a former Marine.
He continues to get a standing ovation. At the beginning of his testimony, he threw away his dog tags.
And those were the voices of Amy Allison and Aaron Glantz, anchors for Pacifica Radio, that carried the Winter Soldier event live and made the audio available. To find out more about GI resistance and to get help, visit IVAW.org, the Iraq Veterans Against the War. Thank you for listening.